This is your brain on risk. This is Mind Over Money, the podcast where Kevin Cook exposes the psychology of investing.
Welcome back to Mind Over Money. I'm Kevin Cook, your field guide and storyteller for the fascinating arena of behavioral economics. Today, I've got a great guest. He's a psychiatrist, Dr. Judd Brewer, and we're going to talk about how your brain works because that's his life work. And he's been at it for over two decades, and he just has a lot of fun teaching people how their brains work, but especially people that, you know, are experiencing some sort of extra stress in their life, whether it's just anxiety or an addiction or some kind of trauma. He has worked specifically with mindfulness techniques and not necessarily meditating, although he does that and we talk about that. But mindfulness can come in many different forms, and I think our conversation opens that up. So we're going to hear about that. He wrote a book in 2017 called The Craving Mind. Let me just read this here. From cigarettes to smartphones to love, why we get hooked and how we can break bad habits. First edition was published in 2017. That's called The Craving Mind. And the foreword was written by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is a professor emeritus of medicine at, I believe, the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He was the creator of a stress reduction clinic there and created this, the Center for Mindfulness. So Kabat-Zinn has been at this for a while too, actually teaching meditation and mindfulness techniques for people to, you know, get a hold of their behavior. Now, what Dr. Judd does, if you go to his website, I'm going to, I'll have all these links in the article version on zacks.com, Z-A-C-K-S.com. But Dr. Judd's website is drjudd.com. And he's got a lot of videos, articles on his website. He also, we're going to talk about the apps he uses, because if you caught my podcast earlier this week where I talked to Nir Eyal, the author of Indistractable, he profiled a researcher in Seattle who also uses an app to help people quit smoking. Dr. Judd has his own. Dr. Judd has several. He's got one for eating right, unwinding anxiety. They've got like three different apps, and they're having tremendous success with using these apps for people to become aware of their behavior, mindful of the triggers, and then also the reward aspect, because that's what Dr. Judd talks about, is the three legs of the stool, so to speak: triggers, behaviors, and rewards that go together and create our everyday behavior and or our addictions. So make sure I give you his website there where you can find all this stuff. And we also... we talk about the smoking cessation research and what's worked and what hasn't. Dr. Judd Brewer's got some interesting insights there. I'm going to have his Twitter handle. I'll give that to you right now, but I'll have this in the article version too. He's at Judd Brewer on Twitter, J-U-D-B-R-E-W-E-R. And his YouTube channel has his videos. So that's the good stuff that you want to remember about Judd Brewer. And we, in our conversation, we cover a lot of ground on different things, not just about how the brain works, but how people need to be thinking about the way they're experiencing the crisis right now. A lot of people... during this COVID-19 crisis, it's different. You know, there are some of us who've actually lost loved ones. Not me, but you know, you may know somebody who's actually lost somebody to the disease. And if at the same time you've lost your job, or you're stuck at home and your business is also being threatened, you can imagine the compound stress on some families. So this is a critical time for people to learn different ways to deal with anxiety. And if I don't get that across in my interview with Dr. Judd, I want I want to say right now that this, he is somebody to listen to here, because this is one of the things he's most concerned about, is how people deal with anxiety, and, you know, how they're coping, and if they can find a way out, and deal with the stress and their own behavior better, and not fall into habits that are just going to, you know, create a new habit loop that may not be constructive for them. So that's why you want to listen to Dr. Judd. And that's why I was happy to have him on the show. All right, I'll be back faster than you could spell. Neuroscientist of Mindfulness. And we're back with Dr. Judson Brewer. Judd, Dr. Judd, as they call you, and is the handle for your website, I believe. Thanks for joining us today on Mind Over Money.
No, thanks for having me.
So I want to start by saying I found you very recently, sort of by accident, on Twitter, I think. And I was just immediately captivated by the work you do. You're a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction and research. And you were putting out these videos on Twitter. What was cool about them is you captioned them. So it was like this 2-minute talk, and the captioning actually like engaged me more, because we all get tired of staring at a talking head. And so it just pulled me in, and I'm like, this is really good content. And then what I figured out, because the link you provide, is it would take me to YouTube or something, to maybe a 10 or 20 minute video.
Actually, you had 5 to 7. Nobody has the attention span.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. You've learned that the hard way too. Yeah. So that was really cool. You draw somebody in with, you know, here's the meat of this. And then if you want to see the full presentation, 5 to 7 minute video elsewhere. The other thing that stood out is that you're talking to people at a time of crisis in what I think is a really great need. And that's that, you know, everybody's under some kind of stress. Some people have lost their jobs. Some people have lost loved ones. And then we're forced to be home. No matter what, you know, whether you have work or not, you're forced to stay at home. That creates some added stress. And you're trying to talk to people about how are we going to deal with that stress? So when did you get this idea that the 20 years of work that you've done in mindfulness, addiction research would come in really handy right now during this crisis?
Yeah. Well, there was this time BC before coronavirus.
Right.
I don't know if anybody can remember it, but back in the ancient times, I'd actually been studying anxiety and habit change, like you said, for a long time, for decades. And also, BC, I had my own anxiety in medical school. I used to get panic attacks, actually, in residency. So this was something, you know, that had I've been researching and personally exploring, and then also working with my patients, you know, in my clinic for a long time, because almost everybody that has an addiction in my clinic has a comorbid anxiety disorder too. So yeah, they're pretty highly correlated or highly comorbid. And you can see, you know, a lot of folks have anxiety and they tend to fall into drug use or drinking or whatever because of that as a way to temporize that. And then they get stuck. But for the coronavirus pandemic, I was seeing so much information come out around the physical virus, you know, here's how to stay safe, here's how to socially distance, all this stuff. And I was looking around and was thinking, why isn't anybody talking about the anxiety component of this? Because, you know, there's everything from, you know, fear making our thinking brain go offline when there's uncertainty to, you know, anxiety getting amped up through social contagion. And nobody's been talking about this. So I just got really inspired. You know, you don't want me going into the ICU and intubating people. That's probably not a good idea. I haven't done that since residency. So, you know, where I could actually step up and help out was with this stuff. So it kind of, I kind of kicked it off with a New York Times article that I wrote about this, and then started putting out daily YouTube videos, you know, 5 to 7 minutes, to give people a little bit of the science, because so they could understand how their minds work, and then give them a little bit of the practice, because mindfulness practice has been shown to be really good at helping people work with anxiety. And, you know, we've even done, we just published a study with anxious physicians for our app-based mindfulness training program, this app called Unwinding Anxiety, where we got a 57% reduction in clinically validated anxiety scores, and we got a 50% reduction in certain aspects of burnout. So, you know, this was something that, you know, my lab happened to be studying. I happened to be doing this stuff in my clinic, and then also, you know, studying how mindfulness training can actually help. So that's kind of where the inspiration came from. I just felt like there was a need, and I needed to step up.
Yeah. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more. Did you just mention an app? Was that an actual app that somebody could have on their phone that was training or reducing stress, anxiety in some way?
Yeah. There's an app called Unwinding Anxiety. It's actually our third app that we developed. But people can download it on Android or iPhone or whatever Apple is. Yeah, it's cross-platform. And we've done 2 clinical studies now showing that it's got pretty robust effects.
And we can find out information about those apps on drjud.com, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. DRJUD. The shortest URL I could think of.
Ah, that's perfect. Yeah. The serendipity here is so cool because, as you may know, on Monday I had as a guest on the show Nir Eyal, who just wrote this book, Indistractable. Mm-hmm. Now, Nir's not a doctor, but he plowed through a lot of research to help him come up with some ideas about how to be less distracted in this world that's always trying to steal our attention, and you know, how to finish your book, or you know, how to get more done at work. And some of the research he dove into was about, for instance, smoking cessation. So I'm enjoying Nir's book and talking to him about it. And all of a sudden I see in the citations of all the research, I see your name because you did this work. You did your own smoking cessation study back in 2011.
Yeah.
One thing I found exciting, this more tangible thing that Nir shared was this study of Israeli flight attendants in 2014. And it just, that one just jumped out at me because it was so tangible. Flight attendants who smoked, you know, some are flying to London, 3-hour flight. They asked them to note when their cravings cropped up, mm-hmm. versus the flight attendants who went from Israel to New York, a 10-hour flight. They asked them to also write down, when did your cravings arise? How did you deal with them? Yeah. And the stunning results were that the flight attendants on the longer flight across the Atlantic, 10 hours, did not report the same urgency of cravings as soon as the ones going to London. And it totally gets across this idea of how much our minds are at play in ramping up our craving or our anticipation of getting the addiction fixed, not just the physical nicotine. Yeah. What did you find in 2011?
Yeah. Well, the one liner there is, if we don't know how our minds work, how are we possibly going to be able to work with our minds? So in 2011, this was on the heels of a study I'd done in residency training where I looked at mindfulness training for people with alcohol use disorder and cocaine use disorder. And I just wanted to see, you know, how did it stack up to gold standard treatment? So we compared it to cognitive behavioral therapy. We actually found that it was as good as CBT at helping people not relapse to drinking and drug use. Random small study, granted. But we also found that they were actually less provoked by individual stressors. So they were less psychologically and less even physiologically reactive. We could measure different physiologic parameters. So that got me really interested in saying, okay, wait, maybe this stuff could actually help, you know, with addictions. So we really zoomed in and did a carefully designed randomized controlled trial, bringing people in who wanted to quit smoking, where we randomized them to get mindfulness training or we randomized them to get cognitive therapy. We, again, compared it to gold standard treatment, the American Lung Association's Freedom from Smoking Group as our control. Long story short, we got 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment. And that blew my mind. So I said, wow, there's something to this. And we started looking mechanistically to see what was happening. And we could see that mindfulness actually decoupled that urge to smoke from smoking itself. Now, more recently, we've even followed this up with neuroimaging studies where we have this app called Craving to Quit, where we could randomize people. Well, we could, at baseline, we could bring people in who wanted to quit smoking. We could show them smoking cues in the fMRI scanner so we could scan their brains while they were getting getting hyped up and caught up in craving. And we could then randomize them to get mindfulness training, or we use the National Cancer Institute's Quit Guide app. Scan them a month later and see how well they did. So one, we found that there was a dose-dependent relationship between the mindfulness training and the reduction in cigarette smoking. So the more modules they completed, the better they did. The control group did the same number of modules, but no correlation. Didn't matter how many modules they did, it didn't show a correlation. And we found that the more that we could actually target this brain region that gets caught up, that gets activated when you get caught up in craving, the more it reduced in activity, the more likely people were to cut down on smoking as well. Again, control group, no correlation. So here we're seeing this very, very, we can take a theoretically derived training where mindfulness is there to help people with urges. We can target a specific brain mechanism, and we can show that that targeting specifically leads to clinical outcomes. To me, that's the holy trinity of science, where you have theory that lines up with neurobiologic mechanism, which lines up with clinical outcomes. And this had actually, this was about 10 years in the making. We'd actually discovered this brain network a bunch of folks had looked at this brain network in turn. It's called the default mode network, where it gets activated with smoking cues, gambling cues, chocolate, all sorts of cocaine, all sorts of things activate this network. We had found back in 2011, again, when we looked at experienced meditators across the entire brain, only a couple of brain regions were deactivated, specifically in experienced versus novice meditators. And lo and behold, it was this default mode network, these hubs of the default mode network. So we could actually take what we'd learned cross-sectionally from experienced meditators. We could then design these prospective, randomized controlled trials and show that we can target that brain mechanism in people who want to quit smoking. I mean, that's been really fun to do that research.
Yeah. Wow. I got to learn more about the default mode network. I've been hearing about it more, and it sounds like such a key finding. I want to come back to mindfulness because there's a lot to talk about there, but I want to drill in on something that was also a big motivation for me to want to call you up. And that's very specifically, you're talking about dealing with anxiety. People could develop some less than healthy habits during this time, right? Yes. And the one that I think of is like, hey, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere, right? And we could be at home. Normal people who are just social drinkers who might think, hey, I'm fine, everything's fine, I'm working from home, I'm getting my stuff done. They could be slipping into habits that may not be that good for them down the road.
Just saying.
Right. So what is your advice to people to sort of be mindful and to monitor their own behavior in that area?
Yeah. So mindfulness can mean many different things to many different people. So from a very pragmatic standpoint, I think of one way to think about mindfulness is helping us understand how our minds work, right? And so pragmatically, that means bringing awareness to our experience, but also not I should say also bringing in this attitude of curiosity. So we're not prejudging our experience. We're saying, oh, here's what's happening. What can I learn from this? And how can this help me understand how my mind works? So mindfulness can help here by helping us see the habit patterns of our minds. So there's this very basic learning process. I gave a TED talk on this a couple of years ago, which basically has three core elements: a trigger, a behavior, and a result or a reward. And this all goes back to survival days, and I put a short animation out on my website that actually talks about all the different ways that we can get addicted. It's called Everyday Addictions. So if you think about it, on the savannah, we needed to find food and remember where that food was. So that trigger would be you see the food, you're foraging, you see that food. The behaviors, you eat the food, make sure it's nutritious, or it gives you some calories. And then the reward or the result is that our stomach sends this dopamine signal to our brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. Same is true for avoiding danger. You see the danger, you run away, that's the behavior. And then the reward is you get to live to avoid that part of the savannah. So, fast forward to modern day, most people, you know, have refrigerators. And so you don't have to remember where food is, but that mechanism is still in play. So we start to learn things like, you know, the trigger is we get a little stressed, right? The behavior is, you know, we're like, well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world. And so, you know, we have a drink, and then our brain says, wow, that was nice. I feel less, you know, I feel better. Maybe get a little bit of buzz or something like that. And then rather consciously or generally unconsciously, our brain says, oh, that was good. Do that again. Anytime you're stressed, you should have a drink. And I can't tell you how many patients I've treated who have actually primarily had an anxiety disorder where they have been referred to me because of alcohol use disorder.
Uh-huh.
It's been kind of their temporary fix that has led to more than temporary problems. And then we start to unpack that and help them see how the, you know, the drinking doesn't help, and also get at the root cause of the problem, which is the anxiety.
Yeah, that's great. So key. I'm glad you told that story. Now, you mentioned a video. It's called Everyday What?
Everyday Addictions.
Okay.
Because right? We can be addicted to anything. You know, The classic definition that I learned in residency of addiction is continued use despite adverse consequences, right? So we could be, you know, these weapons of mass distraction that we all have in our pockets, you know, that we pay for, these slot machines in our pockets.
Right.
These are things that we can get addicted to these things because we don't know when we're going to get that next text or that next email if we have our email alerts on or whatever. And that type of learning, it's actually called intermittent reinforcement, which is just a fancy term for random rewards. So we don't know when we're going to get that random reward. Well, this goes back to evolution. So if you're out on the savannah looking for food and you suddenly find food, that dopamine firing says, hey, remember this, right? There's an unexpected happening. Well, the same thing is true with texting and tweeting. We don't know when we're going to get a tweet. So we get that, you know, that bing on our phone and our brain says, oh, is that food? As in, you know, that's information. Was that my spouse or my, you know, my new love interest that just texted me? And then this thing starts burning a hole in our pocket because our survival brain is out there saying, go figure out, you know, see who texted you, see who sent you an email or whatever.
And for people who may not rush to watch the video Everyday Addictions, I recommend another video I just watched last night of yours called Hacking Your Brain's Reward System to Change Habits.
Yes.
And it's the cartoon version where the pen is drawing and it sticks in your mind. Like, you're really explaining, you know, this is how our brains work, and this is how what creates behavior based on how reward systems, you know, what you just described. So if you want the cartoon version, go to Dr. Judd's website and look at the videos and look for Hacking Your Brain's Reward System to Change Habits.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I actually just finished writing a book on this. I've been blown away by how little people have actually looked at the neuroscience of habit change. And there are all these heuristics around, you know, increase your willpower or you know, tiny habits or whatever, all this stuff. But all of this is based on prefrontal cortical function, where we're assuming that everybody is Mr. Spock, where they can just rationally go through their life and not be swayed by their emotions. But that's not how our brains work. Our prefrontal cortex is the youngest and the weakest part of our brain from an evolutionary perspective. It's the first part of the brain that goes offline when we get stressed out. We cannot trust it, right? We can't think our way out of a bad habit. We can't think our way into a new habit. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many books written about this stuff. Right? And I could just tell my patient to quit smoking and they would quit smoking. So I've been blown away by how people don't actually look at how our brains work. And that's why I put this video together. It's actually based on one of the chapters in my book. The idea is that reward-based learning is what drives everything, as in how rewarding something is. And my lab's done a bunch of research around this, you know, and this is where we can get, you know, we get a 40% reduction in craving-related eating with this app, Eat Right Now. And we get it, you know, with our unwinding, our Craving to Quit app around smoking. You know, all of this is around helping people see really clearly how unrewarding these old behaviors are. I'll give you a quick example. You know, somebody, I think this is in the animation, where we had somebody pay attention as she was smoking, and she said, oh, smells like stinky cheese and tastes like chemicals. Yuck, right? So when you really pay attention and you see that smoking tastes like crap, that reward value naturally drops.
Instead of
yourself, oh, I shouldn't smoke, right? That's the thinking part. You just see it for yourself. And then when something tastes like crap, it's much easier to stop doing it. You know, yeah, sorry to interrupt, but I had this guy who had been smoking 40 years and he wanted to quit and he came to me. So we mapped out how many times he'd reinforced that habit loop, 293,000 times, right? And so I had him pay attention and he looks at his cigarette and he's like, how did I not notice this before?
Wow.
It's been on autopilot for 40 years.
Yeah. And that video, the hacking your brain's reward system video, actually starts out with cake versus broccoli, I think.
Yeah.
I got to have my daughter watch it because she doesn't like broccoli. But just using those two things and how your brain can assign rewards to, you know, the sugary, sweet, or the vegetable. And you can have some control over that is the whole idea.
Yeah. And that control comes through awareness, not through willpower. That's right. The paradox here. It's not through willpower. I said, you know, go for it if you think willpower is going to save you.
You mentioned you have a new book coming out. I want to talk about your 2017 book, The Craving Mind, which, you know, obviously summed up a life's work in the field. I want to read the subtitle here real quick from Amazon. So, The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. So there's the science if anybody wants to check it out in that book. And what I also found exciting was that the foreword was written by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who wrote Full Catastrophe Living. He's at some medical center in Massachusetts, I believe. How long have you known Jon Kabat-Zinn?
Probably 15 years at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, met him in the early 2000s when I was first getting into this research.
One of the early doctors, you know, teaching meditation and mindfulness and still going at it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He is prolific. He really, you know, was the first person to kind of put mindfulness into a scientific paradigm in the sense of, you know, a 8-week, you know, program that you can bill for, you know, because that's how Western medicine tends to work. And really, you know, did the first studies in at least in Western medicine around how mindfulness can help with chronic pain, for example.
And this ties into your thesis about not just knowing how the mind works, but that awareness of your behavior creates certain insights and gives you the power to change. So how do mindfulness and meditation help many of your patients become more aware?
Yeah, well, again, this goes back to this hacking this reward-based learning system. You know, we all have the capacity to be aware, and we can't actually force ourselves to be aware all the time. You know, a lot of people come to me and say, why can't I just be more concentrated? Well, again, willpower fails. And I'd actually tried that for 10 years, trying to force myself to pay attention to my breath during meditation retreats before I realized I was actually not following the practice, which is to get curious about what's happening. So I think of curiosity as a superpower, but even if you look at the ancient Buddhist psychology behind this, they talk about bringing mindfulness and interest or curiosity together. And, you know, if you rub those two sticks together, you know, it's like it creates this energy. And this is actually described back in the ancient Buddhist teachings before paper was even invented, which is fabulous, where it basically taught it in this causal chain of events, we become energized, we become concentrated simply by being aware and curious. And so that's the main thing that I teach people, is to get curious about what a craving feels like, for example. So I remember I had a patient, I was working at the VA hospital down in New Haven back when I was at Yale. And I had a patient who came in and said, you know, he was walking kind of fast, and he comes in and he goes, Doc, you know, if I don't smoke, I feel like my head's going to explode. And so we actually went up to my whiteboard and we just diagrammed out what head exploding feels like, right? Because obviously his head did not explode. And, you know, he was saying, oh, it's tightness, it's tension, it's this burning, it's this heat. And then as we diagrammed it, you know, we could watch the trajectory of how strong it was. And then over time, you know, even in those moments that we were mapping it out, it started to get weaker and weaker and weaker and went away. And he had this aha moment right in my office where he realized, oh, wait a minute, Cravings are made up of these sensations in my body and these thoughts and these emotions, and they come and go. They're not this moral imperative that I have to actually act on. Because he would typically, they would get strong and then he would smoke a cigarette and he would assume, and to some degree it does help, but smoking a cigarette, you know, would make the craving go away. But then it would just engender more craving, more craving, more craving. He also realized that, wait a minute, he didn't have to smoke a cigarette and that craving could go away. And this goes back to that flight attendant study, which I haven't actually read, but I'm guessing what that points out is that, you know, it's not about, you know, well, and I'm even thinking of patients who've gone to therapeutic communities and have gone like a year and a half without any cravings. And then the day they get out, they're on the phone to their dealer because their brain says, you know, I'm in this therapeutic community. There are no drugs here. Why should I have a craving? I'm going to waste my energy. Same is true on a flight, you know, okay. Where the flight attendant's brain says, well, I could crave, but I got 9 more hours on this flight. And so my guess is that craving probably comes in at about the same time, whether it's a 3-hour flight or a 10-hour flight, not having read the study. I could be way off here. But their brain says, well, I'm almost to my destination. I'm almost to the place where I can smoke. And so their brain starts kicking in all this craving and says, okay, get ready because you're almost there. It's like anticipating getting to the food source, right? Yeah. if we're weeks away from getting food, our brains, you know, it's not very efficient for us to be craving that food or that whatever that is, like so long in advance.
Very interesting. So I want to ask you about that. I picture a couple of different types of people that would be thinking that they either couldn't sit and be mindful and or meditate or would just refuse it. So I think of a person who's got some kind of anxiety. Maybe they don't have any, like, no substance addictions, but they've got a lot of anxiety, and they don't want to sit and be quiet and just, you know, be with their own thoughts. How do you help a person like that get started?
Yeah, so this goes back to the science. I was trained, you know, I've been meditating for close to 25 years now. I was trained through, you know, sit down, meditate, watch your breath, you know, all this stuff. And I, in our first study, that smoking study that I mentioned, when we analyzed the data, it turns out that the informal practices, so when people were paying attention as they were smoking a cigarette and using mindfulness tools right in those moments, that was actually a much stronger driving force for people decoupling that urge to smoke with the action as compared to the sitting meditation or formal meditation practices. And that made me step back and really look at this carefully, and I realized, you know, this is about context-dependent memory formation. People learn to do a certain behavior in a context. And so, you know, if you have an urge to smoke a cigarette while you're driving your car, you're not necessarily going to be able to pull over and do a 30-minute meditation. But right. You can, in that moment, you can get curious about what that craving's like, and you can learn to ride out that craving in the moment. So the way I see this is, you know, and even looking at the data, you know, mindfulness is this big umbrella term, and meditation is a smaller, think of it as a big circle. Meditation is a smaller circle within that larger circle, where meditation can train people to be mindful, but you can be mindful without having to meditate.
Right.
So here we actually developed all of our apps based on this principle, which is this short moments many times. So to form a new habit, you have to practice something short moments throughout the day, you know, many times throughout the day. So we designed these apps to train people to first understand how their mind works and then start to use these short mindfulness practices when they had an urge, whether they had a craving for food or for a cigarette or when they had, you know, they were getting caught up in an anxiety habit loop, and to bring these short moments of mindfulness right into their, you know, when they were having a craving or when they were having worry thought loop or whatever, so they could actually use the in the moment practices to be able to work with the anxiety or work with the craving the moment that it came up. And in fact, we're just writing up data for a study we just finished. We found that with this craving tool in our Eat Right Now and our Craving to Quit app, that actually helps people pay attention as they eat or as they smoke. And we found that we can actually mathematically model a reduction in that reward value as people do the behavior simply by paying attention. And it doesn't take 20,000 times for people to do it. It takes as few as 10 to 12 times of people using this craving tool, which is not a whole lot to have this reward value go close to zero. Wow. That's pretty amazing. So the way I think of this is, you know, any moment that we have an urge or any moment that we're caught up in anxiety, that's a moment to bring some curious awareness to this. Oh, what is this? Map out that habit loop. You know, what's the trigger? What's the behavior? What's the result? And then just get curious. Oh, what does this craving feel like itself? Oh, it's made up of this. It's made up of this. Just like my patient who came in with his head exploding. You know, if we can just bring some curious awareness to it, we can actually learn that these thoughts and emotions and sensations aren't as big and bad as our mind makes them out to be.
Fascinating stuff. Now, what about somebody who is all prefrontal and thinks it's all about willpower, but things are showing up in their life? You know, it could be an argument at work, or, you know, marital problems, like stuff showing up in their life and they can't figure it out. What could they do in you know, when they're already like this willpower, you know, prefrontal person?
Yeah.
Where do you send them?
Well, I would say, you know, this goes back to reward-based learning. If somebody thinks they're all prefrontal, I would say go for it. If you think you're all prefrontal, then use your prefrontal cortex and see how well it works, okay? So if it works every time, then you shouldn't need anything else, and they shouldn't need to listen to anything else I have to say.
Right,
but if it doesn't work, they can ask themselves, oh, well, what's the problem here? Why isn't this working? And not from an intellectual standpoint, but really check to see, you know, does my willpower work every time? You know, there's some controversial studies suggesting that willpower actually gets depleted as people go throughout the day. The more controversially, some people say there's no such thing as willpower. You know, cognitive neuroscientists don't actually put in their mathematical models and their neuron modelings willpower. It's more of a heuristic to them than something that's real. What they put in their models is reward value, because that is something that's measurable both in animals, you know, both in mice and in humans. So if somebody's all prefrontal, I would say, you know, if you're all prefrontal, go for it, and then see where it fails, and then see if you can explore why it fails. You know, has your prefrontal cortex gone offline? Can you trust it? And if you can't trust it, find something that you can trust. Hint, 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 take these older, stronger parts of the brain and start exploring there.
So kind of where I'm going with this is, a particular group of people that I work with are traders and investors.
Okay.
And active day trading is one of the most stressful things you can do, because, you know, if you've looked at any of the behavioral finance literature, you know, our brains tend to do the wrong things at the wrong time consistently and make our money go away from us. So a lot of traders aren't going to find themselves sitting around meditating, but what advice they will take is to journal. Because if you can write down your experiences and your thoughts and your feelings against whatever your plans were, against whatever happened in the external market, then you sort of build up this library of, you know, this is what happened, this is how I felt, these were my results. And so do you work with journaling at all with any of your patients?
Not so much, but I think the closest I've gotten to that is I've had some patients and some students write down, like map out habit loops so they can start to identify habit patterns. And so if somebody is into journaling, I would say they can certainly do that. You know, what triggered my mental behavior of worrying or get freaking out or whatever? And then what was the result of that? How well did things go when my prefrontal cortex started going offline?
That's
so
good.
That would be a great way that people could add that to their journaling.
Yeah, because that's actually one of the highest reward benefits of traders journaling, is that they get to see the habit loop, because they already know if they broke one of the rules and that it resulted, even if it didn't result in a loss, they know they probably shouldn't have broken that trading rule. And so they go back through it. Okay, what triggered it? Was it because I watched that news story in the morning, then I did this, or I saw this guy making a lot of money, so I followed him, and, you know, they got off their plan. So if they go back and find that loop, they can learn a lot in that. So that, in a sense, that's awareness for them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Judd, this has been a great conversation. I am encouraging people to go to your website, check out the stuff you're doing, follow you on Twitter. And I always create an article version of our conversations that will be on the Zacks website, zacks.com. So people can go there for all the links and find you. And I'll probably link to a video or two of yours that, you know, because the work you're doing is just, you know, it's like you're a master mechanic or an engineer and you're like, hey, let's take off the hood of your brain. Let's go inside there and see how things are working. And yes. We can never get enough of that.
Great. Great.
Thanks, Dr. Judd.
My pleasure.
This material is being provided for informational purposes only, and nothing herein constitutes investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, or a recommendation to buy, sell, or hold a security. Do not act or rely upon the information and advice given in this podcast without seeking the services of competent and professional legal, tax, or accounting counsel. Publication and distribution of this podcast is not intended to create, and the information contained herein does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No recommendation or advice is being given as to whether any investment or strategy is suitable for a particular investor. It should not be assumed that any investments in securities, companies, sectors, or markets identified and described were or will be profitable. All information is current as of the date herein and is subject to change without notice. Any views or opinions expressed may not reflect those of Zacks Investment Research as a whole.